Welcome to The Lobbying Show, a podcast about the people in government relations, how they got into it, what their jobs entail, what works, and what doesn't. I'm your host, Jim O'Brien. Welcome back to another episode of The Lobbying Show. And this week, we are not coming to you from the floor of the CES convention. We interviewed Brian Chase last week from Bell. That was fantastic. Hope you enjoyed that. I thought we were going to have a number of episodes in a row from CES, but we are going to interrupt those shows to bring you a special episode. We sit down with David Quam. David Quam was the Deputy Executive Director of the National Governors Association. The NGA, as most of you know, is the nonpartisan Governors Association. And he worked with the governors over those years, representing them on Capitol Hill. And when he left the NGA, he went over to Denton's, the largest law firm in the world, and he is now co-leader of their Denton's 50 team, which has consultants in all the state capitals in the U.S. So David now helps to oversee that operation. Clearly, his role working with governors could not have been better training for his current job. And as our longtime listeners know, we are part of that network. And he has got, I don't know about the best story, but one of the best stories about how he got his job on Capitol Hill. So we're taking a little bit of break from Las Vegas, which, you know, I guess everybody has to do. And we will probably be coming back to you with another show from CES next week. But in the meantime, enjoy our conversation with David Quam, the co-leader of the Denton's 50 Network. So here we are again at the Denton's office in downtown DC at 19th and K, ground zero for lobbying. And we are talking to David Quam, who is the co-leader at Denton's of the Denton's 50 team. David, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. And it's great to be here.
Happy New Year.
This is Happy New Year to you. This is an incredible office. It is just really just spectacular. So, David, I wanted to start off by talking about you worked for 12 or 13 years at the National Governors Association. So you were, I mean, dealing with the governors, overseeing, you know, interacting with these governors across the country. It's nonpartisan, which, you know, is very interesting, obviously, today. Tell us about how you came to work at the NGA and about your work there.
You know, I've been working in Washington, D.C. for quite a while, both with law firms, trade associations. I'd spent some time up on Capitol Hill as counsel on the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Prior to the NGA?
Prior to the NGA. So I was a very young attorney up on the Senate Judiciary Committee. That kind of put me on this path. But when we were there, we used to do a lot of work with the states and the governors. And I always respected the National Governors Association and National Conference of State Legislatures and was always fascinated by that relationship. So an opportunity came along to interview for a job with the National Governors Association. They brought me in. And it just so happened that the guy who was heading the lobby shop at the time was on his way out. They asked me if I wanted to talk about that job. We hit it off. Next thing you know, I was heading up the Federal Relations Office of NGA. And
your first job at NGA was heading up the Federal Lobbying Office.
I got brought in. I was very, very fortunate, but got to head the federal lobbying team, about 13 people representing the nation's governors to Washington, D.C. And it was a fantastic job. You have your fingers in everything. The scope and breadth of those policy issues, it was an amazing job. I really enjoyed it.
Now, do you remember what the hot topics were, the hot issues when you first took over?
Oh, absolutely. Well, we were coming off, when I started there in 2003, you're coming off the dot-com bust.
Okay.
States were in a recession.
Reeling, budget problems.
Real budget problems. And so that was the first time they put sort of a state package together. It's about $20 billion. And that was going to come out to the states. And when I came in, it was, how's that going to be distributed? Is some money going to go to the locals? Is it going through the state? What's it going to look like? And how much is this going to help? And for the federal government, it's like, how much can we dictate how you spend it? So my first job was to basically say, look, states will spend it the best way. Thank you for the money. Let's get out of this recession and let's get the economy rolling again. And that was kind of my first job, was dealing with how are we going to spend what then was a huge amount of money. Of course, it paled in comparison to what then happened later in 2008.
Right. And so the states wanted to be free to spend the money as they saw fit and Absolutely. Didn't want to be dictated as to what to do with it.
Yeah. That whole, you know, governors as CEOs of their states, they are firm believers that, you know, the less that we can have federal interference, especially when it comes to money, the better off we're going to be. And I learned very, very quickly that governors take that job very, very seriously. The fewer strings, the happier they are.
And so money is obviously a topic that you were constantly dealing with, and in different forms, probably transportation was another area.
Oh, transportation, healthcare was always at the top of the list.
Medicaid,
and then forever the sales tax issue was a big one during my entire
career.
Oh,
yeah, talk about that. You wrote an article about that recently.
So when I came in, it was funny. My boss said, look, you've got a couple of things you have to worry about. You have to worry about this stimulus deal. I need you focused on the budget, tax issues, like what was then internet access.
Okay.
There was a moratorium on your old AOL bill for a while. And then whether or not states could tax internet sales. That was a big one. And there had been a commission report, and it was called Streamline Sales Tax. I had never heard of it. I like Streamline Sales Tax. I thought it was an environmental deal. It wasn't. Had nothing to do with that. But I spent the next 13 years working with state legislators, the governors, industry. How do you put together a system whereby a state could tax internet sales when somebody is not physically present in the state? And so if you think about it, all electronic commerce, I mean, we all think about Amazon now, and it's like, of course, I buy online.
Right.
Well, back then. Back then, the issue was Nexus. If you weren't physically present, state could not tax. And they were losing tons and tons of money as the internet was growing.
And then did you have a model sales tax framework that states could agree to work within? Is that?
Yeah, so the states came together and they put essentially a state compact together.
Right.
And
okay.
Said, if you agree to this, companies on a voluntary basis, you agree to collect and remit to us, we'll put a system together that works for you. And what we will do is start having common definitions. The biggest one was, what is a grocery, right? What's food? Because some states tax food, some don't.
We just had that debate and it was hotly contested.
One of my favorite is, what constitutes candy? Because cookies were considered groceries, but a candy bar could be taxed as a snack. Well, what's a Twix bar? It's half cookie, it's half candy. This was a hot debate.
We had a debate on meals getting taxed in a certain manner, and then they had to figure out what in grocery stores were meals and what weren't. And you can appreciate complicated that got.
Well, they came down to it, and they're like, if one of the first three ingredients is flour, then it's a cookie.
Is that what they decided?
That's what they decided. That's how that came about. I mean, you can't make this
you
up,
can't make
but
it up.
That was the complexity
yeah.
of the system.
Yeah.
So,
and so now with the Supreme Court ruling, all that has changed.
So we worked for 13 years trying to get legislation.
Right.
Could not get it through.
Legislation in Washington.
In Washington.
Yeah, to allow states to tax internet
yep.
sales.
States did all the hard work, yep. came up and said, okay, we're ready. Yep. And Washington just could not get it done. Eventually, the state said, fine. We'll go to the Supreme Court, dropped a bill in South Dakota. South Dakota runs with it, gets that bill and that law all the way through. And the Supreme Court says, you know what? We made a mistake before. We're going to correct it now. And now we have a brand new system. But that was one of the most intense and long lobbying campaigns I've ever been a part of.
I can imagine. And so now states are free. They can set up their framework as to when the sales tax for internet sales would kick in. I know some states have set the bar at $100,000 or higher, $200,000 or higher, or whatever. But they're free to create a framework that they want to.
Exactly. I think the Supreme Court set some parameters around that.
Yep,
states
right.
have taken taking advantage of that. And what you're going to see is that none of us is going to think twice about paying tax on the internet anymore.
Right.
Everyone's got a system in place.
And we've been paying on Amazon for some time, or at least in, I think in most states. But
well, and that was one of the big things. If you were in, on any of the big sites, you were already paying.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, the old bricks and clicks, if they were there already, you were paying it. You really didn't notice. So something that we're all going to recognize forever, we were part of that change.
Yeah.
That's the birth of the internet till now.
Isn't it amazing, though, that here you worked, you know, I was just thinking, you worked on this issue for 13 years. And for 13 years, it is a battle. I mean, you are fighting tooth and nail, year in, year out. And then it's over and it's resolved. And I can think of a number of issues that are just like that.
We had several that we dealt with. Internet sales tax was one. Another one that we're all still dealing with is Real ID. Real ID is the driver's license issue.
Okay, tell us.
So Real ID was standards put in place by the federal government about what a state driver's license had to look like.
Okay.
This all came out of the 9/11 attacks, right? Well, believe it or not, the federal government had not been in the driver's license business ever before that time. So you had states who did not even require a picture on your driver's license at that point in time. They were pieces of paper. This is, at the end of the day, a license to drive. The state does that, not the feds. Well, as soon as it became a form of identification, this became a big deal. So after 9/11 and after they got on the airplanes, Congress said, oh, we need tougher security. We fought that bill and that law for years because it was going to cost the states $11 billion to implement.
And the feds weren't willing to pay for it.
Feds weren't going to pay a cent. And so the states got together. We worked with the Department of Homeland Security. And year over year, it was just unbelievably complicated. And the deadline for putting it in got pushed back, pushed back, pushed back. Well, guess what? That deadline is finally coming up in 2020.
Oh.
They're already talking about having to push it yet again. And there's one big reason. If you don't comply, you cannot use your driver's license to get on an airplane. That's going to be a big deal. If you get to TSA, you don't have that little star. They say, I'm sorry, you need a different form of identification. That's going to be a big problem for a lot of people.
Now, are there just a few states that are having trouble complying, or do most comply now? Or
most comply now. There are still a handful.
A few that don't.
I mean, this goes to so many different things, from state authority to do the driver's licenses, to the cost of making the change, to civil liberties, privacy concerns, being able to, you know, basically a giant database of everybody in the driver's license system, all the way to immigration issues and who. Do you give licenses to illegal aliens?
Right.
Still an issue state by state. Well, all that goes into this. So that was one of those big issues, though, that while I was at NGA popped up. And it is, states have been doing this for 100 years. Federal government suddenly thinks it's got better ideas. How do you bring those two together? And we are still living with this one today.
And now states are also dealing with, I think, having to give identification to people who don't drive because the identification is, as you just pointed out, needed to get on a plane or do a lot of things.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, think about it. We need identification for almost, in the age of security like this.
Almost anything.
Identification is key.
Pre-9/11, I'm not sure you did. I don't remember.
I don't know about you. I remember getting to the airport with 5 minutes to go and I could get all the way through to that gate. Yeah. I can't do that anymore.
No. No, you cannot. So. No. So Medicaid, transportation, how does NGA get their funding?
So NGA's got, there are two sides to the NGA house. One is what I used to help run, which is the federal lobbying side. And that is all state dues. So every state contributes, pays dues into NGA.
Based on population or?
It's based on population.
Okay.
Exactly. So every time there's a census, those change a little bit.
Yep.
But that way, the whole lobbying side was, the only people I had to listen to as a lobbyist were governors. Those are my clients.
Yep.
Everybody else could come and say what they wanted. It was governors I was going to listen to.
Yep.
Then there's what's called the Center for Best Practices at the time. It takes in foundation money, project money. They do very specific research on state policy issues. They're like a consultant firm for the states. And they'll do a lot of the big research. they'll do a deep dive into like public-private partnerships and infrastructure. How do you restructure a Medicaid program? What's the best way to deal with LIHEAP payments long-term? Big on education, healthcare, security, infrastructure, economic development. And that was honestly the bigger side of the house. They had to do a lot of work with state capitals, coming up with the best policy, the best research to inform governors.
Yeah, I mean, the best practices. I mean,
exactly.
I mean, I can't think of a better platform to kind of air out and come to best practices than NGA. I mean, because if you get, you know, half a dozen governors, you know, engaged on an issue, I mean, if you get a white paper that comes out of a think tank to the NGA and it starts getting some, I mean, you're now off to the races.
Well, and that's so much of what I do as a practice now. I still really work with these groups because Governors Association, again, the Conference of State Legislatures, the counties, the mayors, all of them have these structures where those elected officials are going to their associations and saying, how can I do this better? Well, if you can be part of that conversation, now you're doing what I call is national state policy. And there's so much more happening at the state and local level, as you know, versus yep. what happens at the Fed.
Yep.
You know, at the federal level, I can read the Washington Post to figure out what's going on. I mean, yep. it's more complicated than that, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
At the state level, my favorite saying is, once you know one state, you know one state. And so you really got to work at it for all 50 states. But it's fun to be able to bring them all together, share best practices. And at the end of the day, that whole laboratories of democracy, it really is true.
Yeah, yeah. And they, how often do the governors get together? How many times a year?
Officially, they get together twice a year.
Okay.
Twice a year. So they do it. They get together in February here in Washington, D.C.
Yep.
And then they do a state meeting during the summer when the governors will host, bring everybody in. So that's more state focused. Their federal meeting, they'll meet with the president, they meet with cabinet officials.
Yep.
That's that whole intersection between states and the feds.
And you know, I'm not sure how to ask this because I don't want you to leave people out, but who were some of the governors that you spent the most time with or that you liked? Or, I mean, obviously you liked them all, but.
Of course I liked them all.
Yes.
They were every single one of them. Yeah. Well, I will tell you this. One thing about a governor, to get to that level, these really are some of the most dedicated public servants
yes.
I've ever seen. I mean, men and women who really loved their jobs.
And who are running a state.
And you're running a state as an executive.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, you're making decisions.
Right. The number of governors who then would become senator, and I go up and see them in the U.S. Senate, and they'd be like, David, boy, do I miss being governor.
Yeah.
I made more decisions before 9 o'clock than I will make in 6 months up here.
Yeah.
And most of them get really frustrated until they sort of find their rhythm in the Senate.
Yeah.
But it's a big change between being a CEO and, yeah. you know, being one of 100 if you're in the U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
So that difference between the legislative mindset and the executive, that's a big deal.
And so when you're the head of the NGA, is the term 1 or 2 years?
So at first you are the vice chair.
Okay.
So and then you become chair.
Okay.
And they always switch, Republican and Democrat.
Yep. And they're chair for how long?
1 year.
1 year. Okay.
Chair for one
so
year.
So during your time, you served under
I did.
13 governors.
Yep. Wow. And those were the men and women that I spent the most time with, was
okay.
the folks who were in at that leadership level. They would help set the agenda, help set the priorities. My first one, Dirk Kempthorne, who went on to become, I mean, he had been mayor, U.S. senator, then governor, came back and, you know, ultimately was a secretary of the interior, you know, now runs one of the big associations here in town. So I still keep in touch with him.
Which association?
He's the life insurers.
Oh, okay.
ACLI.
Yep.
But, you know, I mean, these governors, they run associations, they're on boards, and
yeah.
again, it's fascinating where they land. But he was one of my first, Janet Napolitano.
Okay.
She was the first female chair of NGA when she came in. You know, Tim Pawlenty out of Minnesota, Ed Rendell out of Pennsylvania, Jim Douglas out of Vermont, Chris Gregoire out of Washington State. Those two actually helped negotiate some fundamental changes to how the National Guard works. And that was a big issue, you know.
That Governor Douglas spearheaded.
Governor Douglas and Governor Gregoire, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And what was the issue with the Guard?
Oh, well, yeah, we'll jump into a couple of stories here. So after Katrina and the mess that happened down in Louisiana and Mississippi,
yep.
and the National Guard was sent in, but so was the full-time military. Well, squaring off who's in charge during a disaster became a big deal. And governors used the National Guard as their first responders and a hurricane is a governor's responsibility. This is local, and this is serious. Well, after New Orleans, Congress came in and said, hey, this was kind of embarrassing the way this worked out. We had federal forces down there, but they have no police powers. You got the National Guard. We're not coordinated. So we're going to pass a law that says if it's a natural disaster, the president can take over the guard to handle the disaster. The governors did not like that. Not at all.
I can imagine.
This is their number one tool. And they take very seriously that commander-in-chief role of the National Guard, especially since the Guard started in rotations after 2001. So in one of the most exciting lobbying jobs I've ever been a part of, in 1 year, the governors came together, all of them together, 55, and said, we don't want this, we need to change it, and got that law reversed in 1 year. It got repealed the following year. Then they proceeded to work out a deal with Congress. There's something called the Council of Governors, 10 governors appointed by the president, 5 R's, 5 D's. They work with the Pentagon on all National Guard issues to make sure that the authority of the governors and the role of the federal government actually works together. And so since that time, and again, Chris Gregoire from Washington and Jim Douglas, they were on this council, they worked out a deal. Well, how does the National Guard and the federal government respond together during every national emergency? That is still in place today, works so much better, but it all came out of Katrina. It all came out of a fight between the governors, the president, and the Department of Defense and the Armed Services Committees.
That's a great story and a great example of how the NGA can work.
Yeah, absolutely. And today we've got much better policy, and everybody would agree.
Right.
Actually found something that works.
Right.
Versus, you know, what was, I'll call it a knee-jerk reaction to a crisis before. So,
how big a staff is there at the NGA total?
It's about 100.
Okay.
About 13 in the lobbying shop at full speed. Mm-hmm. When fully employed, another 60 doing the Center for Best Practices work, and then other staff. So it's about 100.
Before we talk about Denton's, how did you get your job on the Hill?
Oh, I was doing a networking interview with a chief of staff for a senator from Colorado. I came in on a Friday. The chief of staff said, you know what? I'm losing my 2 law clerks. Can you come back on Monday? I can't pay you, but I've got an antitrust hearing I could use some help with. Said, sure. I'm a 24-year-old counsel. I'll come back.
Wait. So you're coming in Friday afternoon for a typical networking. Hey, yep. How you doing? Trying to find a job.
I'm here in D.C. I'm 24 years old.
And the chief of staff says, yeah. Can you come back in Monday? We got a hearing and I need a lawyer.
You got it. On antitrust.
And at this point, the only antitrust that you knew was that, you'd maybe had one class in law school on it, if that?
I'm not sure I actually took that class. So I read up over the weekend.
Now, you didn't go to Vanderbilt Law School, and you did go to Duke undergrad. So you're obviously not a dumb guy. So you probably could handle it. So how was the antitrust hearing on Monday?
You know, we got through it.
You obviously did pretty well because you got the job.
We did well. You know, the bigger thing was 2 weeks later. So I got through that hearing. 2 weeks later, they opened up an investigation of Denver International Airport. If you remember way back when, this is when they were building it. And again, needed a lawyer to help do some oversight and go through a bunch of documents. So they said, hey, why don't you stay on? Can't pay you much, but if you want to help us out, we'd love to have you. That started a couple-year run on the Senate Judiciary Committee.
That's great.
It was fun. It was a lot of fun.
And who was the chair of the Judiciary Committee at that point?
So we had 2 of them. My first chair was Joe Biden.
Okay. That's why
he was chairman. I was there during the Biden crime bill. And then I was there for the Republican Revolution. And Chairman Hatch came in. Newt Gingrich became the Speaker of the House. And I will tell you, we had the contract with America, for those who remember what that was. But of the 10 elements of the contract with America, most of them ran through the Judiciary Committee. I was on the subcommittee on the Constitution, which meant I got the Balanced Budget Act, unfunded mandates, light item veto. We did more hearings in the first 100 days than I care to think about. So it was a headsy way to learn how DC works.
That's great. What a great experience for a, what you said, 24-year-old kid out of law school. That's incredible.
It was fantastic.
Now tell us about your work here at Denton's.
So I came to Denton's both because of the people here and the chance to help run this Denton's 50 network.
And tell our listeners what the Denton's 50 network is.
So Denton's 50 is something that was created by the head of our practice, Eric Tenenblatt, former chief of staff out of Georgia. And he put together a network of 50 different firms, people in state capitals who could work together in a cohesive way, not only to refer business to each other, but in order to respond to client needs when clients are dealing with multiple states.
So that if you have a client that comes in and they have an issue in Kentucky and California, you already have boots on the ground. You can pull those people in. And
boots on the ground is the best way to describe it. Even more importantly, though, and you know this better than anybody, you cannot replace being in the state capitol. You cannot do state lobbying remotely. You have to be there. You have to know the players. You have to know how things work. And so having a network where you can actually reach in and know somebody on the ground in all 50 state capitals is a fantastic resource. Well, since I've been working with the nation's governors for 13 years and helping to coordinate what 55 different offices, because we include the territories, this was a natural fit.
A perfect fit. I can't think of a better fit. I mean, really, if you were to describe a job for you after leaving the NGA, I mean, you couldn't describe a more perfect fit.
So Eric and I had a discussion, and we hit it off, and a couple of weeks later, got this to come together. So I couldn't be happier than to be here helping to, you know, take this network, run with it, and do what I call national state strategy. So, you know, if you're a company or an entity or an association who is regulated at both the state level and the federal level, this network's for you, because we're going to tell you how do you operate within the states. We're going to bring the federal component. And right now, anybody who's doing serious business in multiple states has to keep an eye on Washington, D.C., but they've got to be able to play in those state capitals. That's what's so much fun about this network.
And the neat, as you just said, you know, the interplay between the state and the federal, I mean, it's critically important.
You know, the states can move so much more quickly and things can get done so much more rapidly in a state. And having to watch multiple jurisdictions, because they can go in very different directions. I mean, when you look at the partisan makeup of the state, there's only one state legislature currently that's split. Otherwise, they're all either solid Democrats or solid Republicans. Only Minnesota has a split legislature.
Huh. That's interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah. And so if you're monitoring the states and you're watching a single issue, you need to know where the differences, where the political differences, where the industry differences, where the economic differences. And that's where, you know, all of our members in the Denton's 50 network knows so much more than I could ever know about what's happening in their state. It's absolutely invaluable.
Yeah, and you have the Denton's firm behind you, which is the largest now law firm in the world, offices across the globe.
Oh, our growth has been, you know, spectacular. It's a wonderful firm to be part of. Over 10,000 attorneys. I mean, we're the largest by a mile. But they're doing it in a way that's really integrated, really global. Big stake in the United States, but big stake around the world. And so just like if you're playing in the United States, you need to be able to do state and local. Mm-hmm. Then you need to have keep an eye on the federal. Well, if you're doing international stuff, you got to keep an eye on the world as well. And that's the way that, you know, the firm is set up.
David, where'd you grow up?
Denver, Colorado.
Okay.
Yeah, born and raised. Actually, Littleton, just south of Denver. So I am a Columbine High School grad. So unfortunately, my alma mater, everybody knows it, but that was my neighborhood. That's where I grew up.
Okay. And how'd you end up? You went to Duke undergrad.
Duke undergrad, left Colorado because I got in, you know, came east and, you know, fell in love with the East Coast, fell in love with Duke.
Yeah.
Stayed out there, of course, went to Vanderbilt Law School just next door. Those two were fantastic complements to each other. Yeah. And then, you know, came to the Maryland area. Started a little bit with the practice of law and then did that networking interview. And once you get bit by this bug, boy, it's hard to leave.
One interview and your entire career path was changed.
Correct.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Just incredible.
I was going to be a litigator
before
that. But
oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was going to be in the courtroom. And then I got that job and I'm like, oh.
That's a great example. I mean, it's just incredible. I mean, but for that one meeting, that one interview, and their need on Monday, you know, you could be just practicing law in Maryland or doing whatever. You could be in a totally different...
You never know what's going to change the course of your life. And
yeah,
something this powerful and, you know, I was very fortunate in a way not to know about the job I had. You know, I was counsel on Judiciary Committee. That's a remarkable place to be. I never forgot, though, that there were 100 people behind me that would love to have that same job. And so I took it, you know, very seriously. It was a privilege to work up there. It was difficult. But boy, once you get into it and you start to realize how the system works, how you can affect change and the view, it was something that remained with me. That's why I still do it today.
So tell me more about the governors.
Well, here's one of my favorite stories. And it was during the transition in 2008. An exciting time. Jim Douglas is actually the chairman.
Transition for President Obama's taking
President
office.
Obama. So President okay. Obama's just been elected, but we're also in the midst of that terrible, terrible recession, right? And the governors are really concerned about what's going to happen to their state budgets. Jim Douglas, the governor of Vermont, is the chairman at the time. And talk about being the right place at the right time. He was that steady voice. But two things happened. Number one, there was a meeting where all the governors met with the president-elect in Philadelphia, in Independence Hall, a private meeting to talk about how are we going to work together with this new administration to try to bring the country out of that recession. One of the most remarkable meetings. President Obama's not in office yet. He's got what's going to become his senior staff. And they just have a discussion about what can we do to help each other. And the commitment from the governors were like, if you give us money, we are going to spend it quickly. We're going to spend it wisely. If we can't use it like on a big infrastructure project, we'll give it back so somebody else can. And all of that became some of that spending and stimulus bill all went into that coming out of that meeting. But what a remarkable time. Douglas was also key in working with National Guard issues. How does the National Guard work with the federal government? But my favorite Jim Douglas story is as chairman, President Obama has become president. They go over and they're having a meeting at the Oval Office, first time. And there's a picture of this. You know, the furniture in the Oval Office, they'll move around depending if there's been a media event and the guy moved the couches back and that type of thing. Well, the two of them met and afterwards they're like, well, this couch is not where it's supposed to be. And so Governor Douglas was like, well, I'll give you a hand. So there's a picture of the president and Jim Douglas moving the couch.
In the Oval Office?
In the Oval Office. They're just putting it back. Because they're just two guys, you know, who like, okay, I suppose we should put this back where it belongs.
Oh, that's a great story.
It was about two people dealing with some huge issues who at the end of the day are just people just like everybody else. I'm like, yeah, let's move the furniture. And anyway, there's a great picture of it. It spoke volumes to, you know, the leadership, the transition, what was going on. But I think also so important to remember who these men and women are that we work with. They're just like us. Sometimes you just got to move the furniture. And other times you have to save the economy. So anyway, those type of stories happened all the time. Jim Douglas was that type of guy. When honestly, I still love working with him today anytime I get a chance to.
What a great story. If you know, do you have internships here at Denton's? Obviously, you have legal internships. Do you have political type internships?
We always have a couple of interns working with our public policy shop.
Okay.
And our public policy shop, it's bipartisan. We've got some fantastic players on the Democrat side, Republican side, House and the Senate. I really enjoy my peers, so the reach is incredible. But yes, we do internships. We work with different schools to bring folks in. And I'm always amazed at, you know, who can come in, what they can do from a research standpoint, what they understand. I tell you, I think they understand a lot more than I did when I was 24.
And are you, I would imagine you strike me as a person that's totally open for networking people to reach out to you, which they can find you on the Denton's website pretty easily.
Absolutely. Anytime, okay. You know, the ability to talk through a lot of this stuff's really complex. And oftentimes, especially if you're trying to run a company and you know you have to deal with the government, but you don't even know where to start,
yep.
Sometimes you just have to have that conversation. And so much as you know about lobbying, it's not actually about passing a law. It's about having the right conversation at the right time with the right person.
Right.
And that's a lot of what we do. So I'm always open to those conversations.
And last, how does Duke basketball, how are they going to do this year?
I really enjoy this team. Now, I mean, I got to say, last year's team with Zion Williamson, and that was a fun team to watch.
Yes.
This team is hanging right there at number two, and they seem to be doing incredibly well. Being a Duke basketball fan, I got there right at the right time. I saw the UNLV game where we got just destroyed in the championship, went to law school, and then started the run of the championship. So it's been a good time to be a Duke fan. I wear it with pride, and so I'm enjoying watching this team. I hope they take it all the way.
Well, David, it was great to sit down with you, and thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Okay, so this is take 13 of The Out. The Out is what we do at the end of the show. The producers are getting a little finicky about how they like things. So, first and foremost, Jim, you have to tell them to remember to subscribe to the show. Wherever you listen to the show, Google, Apple, Spotify, you may remember, we had Tom Manitos on the show, so now we promote Spotify whenever we get a chance. Shout out to Tom and his work there and his newsletter. Also, so you can subscribe and you can rate the show. Don't forget to rate the show or I'll have to do this out again. You can sign up for our Monday morning email. Where? At our website. What's the name of it? TheLobbyingShow.com. You probably could have guessed that, but I had to say it. Comes out when? Every Monday morning. Coffee with The Lobbying Show. You get little tidbits. It is pretty good, all kidding aside. You can also follow us on Twitter at The Lobbying Show, on Facebook, of course, and Instagram. And I think that is about it. If I get the thumbs up, I got the thumbs up. Okay, I covered all the bases. Now I can say have a great week and see you next Monday.